We're talking today to Phil Anderson, who is the General Manager of Policy and Professionalism at the Association of Financial Advisors. And our conversation topic today, Phil, revolves around education standards for advisors and education standards for risk advisors in particular. I was wondering if you could start off by giving us a quick review of what the minimum education standards are now required of advisors.
Absolutely. Thanks, Peter. So a little bit of context around this. The whole issue of education standards has been one that has been bubbling away for over 10 years. It culminated in a report by the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Corporations and Financial Services in 2014, which recommended the introduction of a degree requirement for new advisors and an exam and a code of ethics. It is a broad package. It wasn't until February of 2017 that the legislation was actually passed, and that legislation required a range of things, including that all advisors would need to pass an exam and that they would need to achieve what's described as degree equivalence status. And that was the framework of it, but the details of it was left to be resolved by FASEA, the Financial Advisor Standards and Ethics Authority, which was created as a result of the legislation. They then went through a process of consultation around each of the core elements of the professional standards regime. We're concentrating today on the exam and the education standard. The exam was, in the end, it was agreed that it would be a general exam rather than a technical focused exam. And we argued strongly that we didn't want to see an exam that would require technical expertise to get the questions right, and therefore you didn't need to know social security details or tax details, but a general understanding of the obligations of financial advisors. Now, ultimately, FASEA has put an exam in place that contains three core areas: illegal obligations, ethical considerations, and an understanding of the advice process. Well, I think that's probably a reasonable outcome. Advisors initially had until the end of 2020 to pass that. The government announced in August of 2019 that they would provide a 12-month extension. So there's a deadline of the end of this year, the end of 2021. Now, the progress with the exam to date is based upon the January-February 2021 exam is approximately 57% of registered advisors have passed the exam. But we have been observing that the pass rates have been progressively declining, and we are certainly very concerned about that. The announcement just yesterday that the pass rate from the January-February exam of 67% is a lot lower than was the case in the November exam. Now, there's been a lot of pushback across the sector in terms of the appropriateness of the exam, and most recently the stockbrokers have been quite outspoken because their view was that this was not fair to stockbrokers who are specialists and don't necessarily operate in the broader financial advice space. Now, we've also been concerned about this in terms of life insurance advisors, where they are specialists in one area, and the exam, if it was going into detail of superannuation investments, then it may be going into areas that they simply don't understand. And I think there is the prospect of that. There are certainly areas in the Corporations Act, like fee disclosure statements, that life insurance advisors never deal with. So that's where we're up to with the exam. In terms of the degree equivalence requirement, ultimately FASEA chose to put a standard in place that was a graduate diploma, an 8-subject graduate diploma, and with credit for certain previous study. And they have given study credit for what they've described as relevant degrees, non-relevant degrees, advanced diploma of financial planning or equivalent, and professional designations. We remain concerned that they haven't, despite the reference to this in the explanatory memorandum to the bill, given recognition for diploma level study, CPD, or other technical study that might be run by licensees, for example. Now, this is clearly spelled out in the explanatory memorandum, but it has not yet been delivered. So our concern is that a lot of, particularly, I guess, those who came into the profession a long time ago, did the study that was required at that time, none of which is recognised, and they've done CPD in large part since, which also is not being recognised. So the deadline for degree equivalence is the end of 2025. I think advisors at the moment are more focused on the exam than they are on the study, and we'll wait to get new numbers on how many people are actually in the process of completing the study. But our concern is that some are leaving it late if they intend to achieve it. And also our concern is some have chosen not to. And we would like to make sure that everything is done to encourage as many advisors as possible to commit to do the study, if we can give them a proposition that is attractive for them to want to stay in financial advice.
Okay. Back to the exam for a minute. Do you think, whilst there may be valid arguments for perhaps more targeted exams for advisors that specialise in a particular area of advice, that the horse has bolted and that the exam as it is now will remain until the end of 2021? And following up on that, what assistance is out there for advisors who haven't undertaken the exam as yet in terms of preparation, and also helping advisors work through their minimum education standards?
Thanks, Peter. Look, I think a couple of really good questions. Has the horse bolted? Well, I think the horse is certainly on the track, and is probably in many ways turning the bend into the into the final straight. Yeah. I imagine we've got to view this also in the context of what's happening with FASEA. So with FASEA now expected to be wound up over the course of the next 6 months, can we expect that FASEA will make changes to the exam? I think that's highly unlikely. I think that advisors should not operate on the basis of an assumption that there is going to be any change, because there's been no evidence to suggest that the government or the parliament, for that matter, is prepared to pursue further changes. They've already given a 12-month extension. So I'd encourage people to be thinking about completing it this year, and put in place plans to start sitting it as soon as possible, to give yourself as many chances as you possibly can. One thing that I would say is that we will be watching it very closely. We're concerned about the results from the January-February 2021 exam, and we will be talking to government on a regular basis about the status of this over the course of this year. And if the progress is slow, then we will be raising those alarm bells. So your question also was about assistance. Now, the Kaplan and the Tau Risk Academy have been providing courses to assist people in preparing for the exam, and that has been very useful for the significant number of people who have done that, and we congratulate both of them for that. Kaplan, at the moment, theirs is available for free, and TALS is very well priced, and whatever they are paid, that money goes to charity. So I think we've got to recognise the significant contribution of Kaplan and TAL as part of this to help people prepare for the exam. And we've got to also recognise that this is incredibly challenging for people to be told you need to sit an exam to continue to do the job that you've done professionally for many years. So the assistance is really important. The other thing that's really important right now is that FASEA have significantly ramped up what they're doing to help advisors get through the exam. They are now running a webinar in advance of the exam actually being operated, and that's to help explain how the exam operates, to also take them through some trips and tricks and trips. And that's about, you know, how you should respond to the exam, and about how you should be careful to manage your stress levels and prepare for it in advance. It's about understanding how the questions are asked, because we're getting feedback that a lot of people are overthinking the questions. We're also getting feedback that people are just getting too stressed in the environment, and that's something that they need to be thinking about in advance. You know, how do I keep myself relaxed? How do I keep myself in the right frame of mind? And that's a material challenge. Now, the AFA is also providing support for our members. You know, we've been dealing with questions from members. We've been providing information. We'll continue to do that. We're bringing our members' attention to the various resources that are out there, encouraging them as much as we can to do the training in preparation for the exam. But we're always here to answer questions. We've been speaking to a number of people who have failed the exam on more than one occasion, and just trying as much as we can to help them to know what resources are available, but also trying to, I guess, give them more confidence and more awareness of what's out there to help them.
Okay, and let's just focus a little bit on the ethics component of the exam and the ethics requirements in terms of the minimum education standards. Some advisors, some industry feedback suggests that passing that part of the exam only suggests that you're good at passing an ethics question or getting an ethics question right, but it doesn't make you more ethical. Do you have any response to that?
I think that's a fair comment. I mean, you can be incredibly smart, but very unethical. So I think there is value in it, in that you understand what the ethical expectations are, and it might challenge practices that you've seen in the past. But there's no silver bullet here. It doesn't instantaneously address the intent to commit misconduct.
The other element in terms of industry feedback, and it's one that you've pretty well already covered, is a lot of advisors talking about the fact that they've been advising for many years, and that needing to pass the exam is not going to make them a better advisor, and why should they be required to pass the exam in the first place to continue advising? I guess that's a debate that's already been had, and that they will be required to pass the exam, but do you have do you identify at all with that argument?
I do. I think that the decision by the government to have an exam is locked in, and it's not going to change. But I do understand the argument that, you know, I've been doing this professionally for a long period of time. And ultimately, I guess, we would be comfortable with an end outcome where those who fundamentally did not understand what they're supposed to be doing would end up leaving the industry, as opposed to those who are generally professionals, and they won't be pushed out because they didn't quite get to the mark that they needed to get.
Okay, thanks. Finally, Phil, the advisor has passed the exam. They have their minimum education standards. They've qualified for the minimum education standards required. Where does that put them in terms of advisors in other parts of the world in terms of their minimum standards?
Well, I think the new advisors will have a degree. Existing advisors will have what turns out to be consistent with a graduate diploma. Now, I just do want to make a really important point about life insurance advisors and the standards that have been set for them and whether the course that they need to complete is reasonable given that they are a specialist. And the point that we would raise here is that we want the FSCA regime to change in two ways. We want there to be better recognition for previous study and experience, or CPD, which represents that. And we put forward a model where advisors with more than 15 years experience should get 3 subjects credit. Between 10 and 15 years, they should get 2 subjects credit. And between 5 and 10, they should get 1 subject credit. We think that would go a long way to getting some of the more experienced advisors across the line in terms of having a sense that they're close enough to have a crack at it. Now, the other thing that we want to do is to ensure that there's greater flexibility in the study that's undertaken so that life insurance advisors can focus on studying content that is relevant to what they're doing and it's valuable for their business and for their clients. Now, that might be studying in underwriting or claims management or better understanding the way the products work, more so than it is around understanding asset allocations and derivatives and things like that. So I think at the end outcome of this is, once everyone's gone through this, I think we'll be world leading in terms of the standards, education standards that we have. And I think we had a challenging few years in the meantime, but ultimately I think we'll end up with a very professional financial advice sector in Australia.
Very good. Phil Anderson, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Peter.